Welcome back, listeners, to another edition of the Built on the Border podcast. It is Monday, June 8th, and I'm joined, as usual, by my good friend, Brody Johnson. Brody, how are you doing today?
Oh, it's a good day. Good day to do a podcast.
Yeah, it's starting to finally heat up here in Kansas City. We've had some pretty crappy weather as of late, considering all the clouds and the rain and everything. But it's finally sunny. It's finally summer weather, and we're well into a week of the summer months. You think of June, July, August, those are the summer months. We're a week into it. However, we're a week into another week of bad Royals baseball. Royals have not been performing well as of late. They did, however, get a win yesterday with a late home run by Salvador Perez to give the Royals a one-run lead late in the game in the bottom of the eighth inning to steal one game from the Texas Rangers. The Royals are now opening up a series against the Minnesota Twins this week and then the Major League best St. Louis Cardinals to close out this week. So we'll go ahead and jump right into baseball, start talking about that. This is a 1-2 matchup starting tonight against the Twins at home. Royals need to make a statement in these games. Ned Yost has kind of talked about how these games are just baseball games. You know, there's no real importance to these games. And then, you know, Eric Hosmer's kind of said something to the contrary, saying, you know, they only lost the division last year by one game. You know, who knows where that game came from? It could have come in April. It could have come in May. It could have come in August. So I think you're hearing two different things. Yost is saying we're going to approach this series as we do every game. Hosmer's saying we're going to approach it a little bit differently. We're going to approach it as if these are must-win games. Because at this point in the season, when you have a one-and-a-half game you're back a game and a half on a division rival like the Twins, who have really impressed people with their hot start. You've got to make a statement in these three games. So what are you expecting to see from the Royals this week when we start off the week at home against the Twins?
You know, the one thing I'm looking for, no matter what the win or loss is, I just want to see consistent hitting.
Yeah.
Because I think our offense has just gone dormant, and our starting pitcher hasn't been great.
Yeah.
But it's been enough for what would be a normal offensive team to carry some of those wins.
Absolutely. So, correction, we're only a game behind the Minnesota Twins. The Twins are 33-23. Royals are 31-23. We said last time on the podcast we needed to see some good performances from our pitching staff, specifically Jeremy Guthrie, who has delivered two really strong, solid performances. He actually had a no-hitter going through the fourth inning in his game this weekend. We've seen some strong performances from Guthrie. We've seen the rotation kind of start to hit their groove. Now it's time for them, all the pieces, to kind of hit at the same time, and I no pun intended, but the Royals really need to start hitting the way that they did early on in the season. You know, we still have one of the better offenses in the majors when it comes to batting average, on base percentage, and slugging, but we're not scoring as many runs as we were at the beginning of the season. We've actually dropped from being one of the better run scoring teams to middle of the pack this year. We're 16th in runs scored. So, you know, I'd like to see a consistent week from the Royals. I think if we go 3-3 this week, that's a success.
That'd be perfect.
I think if we go 4-2, we're sitting really pretty, especially if you can steal a couple of games away from the Twins and even up the division, you know, during that time. That said, we're still off to a great start. And the Royals today now have 7 players leading the All-Star voting categories, which is just absolutely amazing, and I know it's pissing off the rest of the country.
Which I love
that is happening right now. So, you know, there's the obvious guys that deserve to start. You've got your Salvador Perez. You've got your Mike Moustakas. You've got your Lorenzo Cain. You could make a case for Hosmer Morales, although it's hard for guys like that when you have Miguel Cabrera and Nelson Cruz having the types of years they are. It's tough to solidify Cain's spot in the outfield when Mike Trout is having a Mike Trout-like season.
Right.
But you can really argue that most of these guys, short of Omar Infante, are deserving, and Alex Rios, are deserving of an All-Star spot. And how great would it be to see an all-Royals lineup in the All-Star game?
I think it would just be perfect. It would kill the national spotlight.
Oh, absolutely.
But, I mean, our record as a team against the National League is great the last 2 years. So
yeah. So
really could bode well for the American
League. Right. And it's you know, people say, well, you know, we lose that home field advantage. We don't get to play Game 7 at home. Well, I need to remind people that the Giants didn't have home field advantage last year in the World Series, and they managed to win Game 7 at home. Unfortunately, it was against the Royals. But I think people are putting too much too much stock into this, you know, kind of fluke. You know, I'm the kind of guy who I've started another email address to be able to vote another 35 times so that I can get my, you know, 105 votes in to help supplant all the other players in the league. But it's just really exciting to know that at the very least we're going to have four or five guys starting that night.
And that's not including the bullpen or manager picks of Ned Yost. And
yeah. So, you know, you've got the Royals, a Royal managing. You've got a Royal who's probably going to be catching. You've got, you know, guys in the bullpen, Herrera and Davis are likely to be guys that are seen, you know, playing on the All-Star team as well. So it's just really exciting. So while the Royals aren't performing as well on the field, you know, they've lost, I think, 8 out of their last 10 games. They're performing exceptionally well from a national attention standpoint.
They've come a long way from the beginning of the year of the bad boys causing fights and disrupting the league.
Yeah, absolutely. I think now they're the kind of the poster children of the American League and of baseball. I think this isn't just coming from a Kansas City crowd that's voting. Now, obviously, we make up a huge percentage of that, but there's still a significant amount of people across the country that fell in love with this team last year and are rooting for us because just the types of personalities and how easy it is to love the boys in blue. So it's going to be an exciting month waiting to see how that final roster shakes out. But there really only are a few weeks left of the voting. So, you know, all signs point to Royal going in the Royals' favor. Take a break a little ways away from baseball now and kind of talk. It's a niche sport for a lot of people. The Women's World Cup is going on right now. I would say sometimes it's as exciting, if not more exciting, than the Men's World Cup, especially from you know, a country affiliation standpoint. The United States women's soccer team is really, really good.
Really good.
You've got Abby Wambach. You've got Hope Solo. You've got Alex Morgan, who we had a chance to meet earlier this year. And you've got these stars that are just kicking ass and taking names. They did it in the last Women's World Cup in 2011. They lost in the final. But you know, this is a really, really good team. And they're off to a great start already against Australia tonight with a 1-0 lead with about 6 minutes into the game. So getting off to an early start, we love seeing that from our women's team. They're playing up in Canada, so our neighbors to the north. Brody, how excited are you to watch these games, especially in group play now, to see these women back in action in 2015?
I mean, it's just exciting just with all the national exposure and everything. And my family, besides my two little sisters and my mom and dad, are actually going to a few games next week.
That's awesome. And, yeah. You know, that's a vet, that's, you know, it's a country that's easy for, you know, United States fans to access, you know, just north of us. It's a beautiful country. Canada is absolutely amazing. Imagine the United States with a imagine the northern United States with way less buildings. I mean, it's a beautiful country, and I think, you know, our women's team is probably comfortable playing there, too. They don't have to travel a long way to get there. And to be able to spend a couple weeks in Canada, you know, playing soccer, I think it's probably just going to be a great time up there, and I'm hoping for the best for our women's team. So exactly. We just want to touch on that shortly and give them a little shout-out because I have a lot of fun watching these games. You know, it doesn't compare to the Men's World Cup just because the stakes feel higher at that point, just because, you know, it's got a larger following. But from a pure soccer standpoint, I mean, there's not much, you know, better team soccer.
Very technically sound.
Technically sound team-based soccer than what you see in this Women's World Cup with the United States national team. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Interested to see how well they do here. I certainly expect them to make it out of group play, but we'll just have to wait and see. So moving out of soccer, I want to talk about a little pop culture. Before we get into the NBA Finals, we want to break the show up a little bit more. This week we had episode 9 of Game of Thrones, a lot of shock, a lot of things we didn't expect. As book readers, you and I both, a lot of things we didn't see coming.
At least this early.
There's been people have alluded to what is going to happen. People have said that George R. R. Martin has indicated these things are going to happen, but we haven't seen pen to paper these things printed out in the books yet. So if you are a show watcher or a behind book reader, stop listening now. There will be spoiler alerts about Game of Thrones. Come, you know, skip forward maybe 5-10 minutes and see where we're at because we're going to talk about some things that happened on the show this week. Want to start off with the first real thing that happened, which I don't really agree with how they placed it in the show. I don't disagree with the content, but I think it should have been the way they ended the show. But King Stannis Baratheon... We really developed a lot of empathy and really, relation, and we empathy and sympathy and respect was a lot of that was garnered for him this season. We saw an emotion, a human side of him we had never seen before in his interaction with his daughter, in his interaction with his wife, in his interaction with Davos. We really saw a side of him where we felt like he was the most human of the characters where we were really rooting for. You know, Tyrion and Jon Snow aside, he became one of my favorite characters of this season. And he takes that and he just dumps all over it. Stannis Baratheon had been told by the Red Priestess, the Lady Melisandre, that they needed another King's Blood sacrifice. Well, who makes the most sense in terms of who's around him with Stannis' army up in the north? Well, that's his daughter, Princess Shireen, who Stannis decides to burn at the stake last night to gain favor of the Lord of Light, of the Red God, Rolor. And it's kind of just a really not distasteful, but hard scene to stomach, because they burn essentially a teenage girl at the stake so that Stannis' army can advance to Winterfell and take the north. So it really seems like a large sacrifice for a rather small victory. But when you think about it, those who control the north control, or those who control Winterfell control the north, and those who control the north control a significant part of Westeros. Yeah. So what were your thoughts on the murder sacrifice of Princess Shireen last night on the episode?
You know, I gotta agree with you where Stannis really became a human in this season, where before he was kind of the stoic, distant king who was trying to lay claim, rightful claim to the throne.
Yeah.
And the interactions with his daughter where it was, he truly loves her.
Right.
And then just the turn of choice by Melisandre.
Yeah.
And it's a shame.
Yeah, it's a shame. Because Shireen, I mean, that actress, she did a great job this season. And she did an exceptional job with that scene last night.
Oh, right. Because
you had almost turned away. It was so depressing and sad.
Well, the way they were able to make her mother,
yeah,
who throughout the season, as I've almost wanted to see die more than
right.
anyone.
We wanted to see her burn at the stake. They humanized her as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And you had empathy for her. It was the first time you really were drawn to that character. Because in the books, neither Selyse or Stannis are really admirable characters. Stannis more so than he is in the show. But it was just really difficult to watch last night. So that was the real shock. I think that, you know, historically, episode 9 is the episode where they deliver the shock. It was the episode where Ned was beheaded. It was the episode with the Red Wedding. It was the episode with Oberyn Martell's head being smashed in last season. So it's the episode that has the shock value in it. I think this is one of the, if you look at the history of the 5 seasons, it's probably the least shocking 9th episode of a season, but nonetheless shocking.
Right.
Then the next big part of the show, there were some subplots. Arya's plot developed. Dorne developed a lot more than I thought it was going to. There's finally a relationship between Jaime and Doran Martell, and there's a relationship now between Jaime and Ilaria Sand. Now these people have now spoken for the first time on the show, and we're seeing a little bit more of character development there. Mm-hmm. But the big story now is in Meereen, where they had the fighting pits and the Sons of the Harpy emerge as the fighting ceases and Jorah Mormont is the champion of the fighting pits. Well, the Sons of the Harpy emerge and start to just kill everybody start to kill all the free people in the city of Meereen. Well, we know what draws dragon's blood in the books, or we know what draws dragons, and that's the smell of blood. And there was quite a lot of bloodshed in the fighting pits in the arena. So amidst all this fighting, it looks to be a no-win situation for Tyrion and Daario Naharis and Jorah Mormont and Dany as they're standing in the center of the arena, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes Drogon. Now, we know this is coming from reading the books, but of course Tyrion is not yet to Meereen, so he isn't there. But did that play out the way you pictured it in the books? Because it certainly was something that I pictured, and then I saw it on the screen, and I was like, that is almost exactly how I saw it playing out.
I mean, it just, you know, having that knowledge really did help, but for a second there, I mean, you do have the feel of everything's going south.
Right, and with the way they had kind of gone away from the books a little bit,
yeah.
I wondered if Drogon was even going to show up. Now, the title of the show kind of gave it away, Dance with Dragons, or Dance of Dragons, so you kind of knew, but there was still that hesitation where you're like, wow, this is the end for Tyrion
One of these groups, now granted that not everyone made it out,
right,
but someone will die, and it's just like it had that feel of who is it going to be? Is it going to be Tyrion? Is it going to be Dany?
Dany's arranged husband, Hisdar, did not make it out. That's right. I find that questionable, though, because originally the Harpies weren't trying to attack him. The next thing you know, Dario Naharis looks back, and he's on the ground. I'm wondering if there's a little bit more there. I don't think that her arranged husband, Hisdar, is dead. I think that he's alive. They didn't really indicate that in the books. He's not dead in the books. So we will have to wait and see. So I'm definitely excited now for episode 10. I don't really know what to expect, because in a lot of these previous seasons, you kind of know what's coming because you have either read the books, or the episode 10 is kind of the way that they
the wrapping up and
of the season
up.
And leading into season 6. So I'm excited for the last episode. I don't want to speculate too much on what's going to happen, but I do think that the majority of what's going to happen next week is going to happen either in Dorne, Winterfell, or at the Wall. So we'll just kind of have to see how that all plays out.
Mm-hmm.
Sticking with the HBO theme, though, we saw a movie last week, a movie that I have been highly anticipating. Maybe you not so much, as not an avid watcher of this show.
Right.
But the Entourage movie debuted last week on Wednesday, June 3rd. And we finally got to see it on Thursday evening when I got back from Atlanta. And I just got to say, it was everything that I expected it to be, everything that I hoped for it to be. As an unseasoned
casual entourage
fan, what were your thoughts on the film?
You know, I went in with the expectation that it was going to be a 2-hour full season. And it, to a lesser extent, it was, but it was a fun movie.
Yeah.
Just cameos out the ass.
Yeah.
Excuse my language, but that's exactly,
what it was.
And it was great. It was not like they were just throwing people out there. It was like it made sense.
It fit into the flow of the story, which is always what I loved about the show in the first place. It never just felt like, the show never felt like they were just throwing a cameo in there to throw one in there. The cameos all served a purpose within the storyline,
right.
And they did so in the movie as well. I think it's one of those things where if you're a celebrity, when you make it on Entourage, you've made it. You know? The performances by Rob Gronkowski, I mean, his very brief lines were hilarious. I mean, everybody that you saw in there, I mean, there were even people that didn't have lines that popped up in the background that you might miss that were in that movie. But not just the cameos, but the story as well.
Right.
It was
right.
Great as a guy who's watched all 8 seasons probably 3 or 4 times, has obsessed over the show, has discussions with friends about who's which character. I, unfortunately, got Lloyd, who's one of the more loyal characters, contrary to me, is a flaming homosexual. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's not my personal persuasion. But it was a great movie. Ari's storyline was excellent. The core four of Vince, Drama, Turtle, and E all just had their own roles to play in it. The storyline between Turtle and Ronda Rousey was interesting. E's whole storyline with the double date and the pregnancies. Vince's storyline as a director. Sometimes I get annoyed with the Vince character on the show. That wasn't the case in this movie. It was a really heartfelt performance from Adrian Grenier. I know you really don't talk about the performances that come out of shows like Entourage or these types of movies, but these shows are what they are, not because of the content, but because of the performances from the actors that you have on there. I mean, the show wouldn't be anything if it didn't have Kevin Dillon and Jeremy Piven performing those two iconic roles of Johnny Drama and Ari Gold. I think people typically who don't watch the show associate Entourage with kind of this douchebag frat boy culture. But if you watch the show, it's a lot more than that. There's a lot to be said in that show about family and loyalty and friendship and relationships. And at the end of the day, the celebrity and stuff doesn't really matter. It's about the relationship those guys have with each other. It's about family. And I think those are things anybody can appreciate. So if you're an adult, because this is definitely an obscene movie, I mean, it is a very unapologetic movie in that it's graphic, it's vulgar, it covers all the bases of everything you want from an Entourage movie. And it's funny and it's heartfelt. It's got suspense. It's got drama. You don't know what's going to happen. It's got drama literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
It's got Johnny Drama, and it's got dramatic elements to it. It's a great movie. So if you're a fan of Entourage or a fan of any of those actors, or you're a fan of just movies with lots of cameos, if you like the movies like, what's a movie? Like new those like Valentine's Day movies.
Every famous person combined in one, but this one, it makes sense,
yeah.
And it's not a love story.
Yeah, exactly. It's a fun movie. It ends fun, and it ends open-ended, too. So I'm excited to maybe see what the next chapter in the Entourage story is. So enough about our, you know, platitudes about HBO shows that we watch. Let's go into the finals. We're two games in. They just played game two last night in Golden State. The Cavaliers were victorious, despite the best efforts of both the referees and J.R. Smith, who both seemed to be trying to give the game away to the Golden State Warriors. So the series is now tied 1-1, heading back to Cleveland, which I don't think is where the Warriors necessarily wanted to be. I originally picked this series, Warriors in six games. I'm still holding true to that because the Cavaliers are, you know, shorthanded without Kyrie Irving, who's a big reason why they made it to the finals this year. But it just got a little bit harder for the Golden State Warriors because I know for a fact LeBron James takes a game in Cleveland. He's going to win a game in Cleveland. He's going to will them to a win in Cleveland. And who knows, he might even will them two wins in Cleveland. So now home court advantage shifts to the Cleveland Cavaliers because they stole a game at home or against the Warriors at the Oracle Arena. So it's going to be an interesting series. Mm-hmm. Steph Curry was very cold last night, missed a lot of open shots, missed a lot of shots barely. There was a shot in the fourth quarter that would have given the Warriors, brought them within 3 points that just went in and out, looked like it was going to be down, and it literally was down on the cylinder and popped back out. So a few unlucky breaks for the Warriors last night. But one thing I wanted to talk about is that I think that the Cleveland Cavaliers have figured out how to guard the Golden State Warriors by taking the ball out of Stephen Curry's hands. And when you do that, you leave guys like Draymond Green and Klay Thompson open around the perimeter. But when you force a guy like Draymond Green to make plays, you saw the effects of that last night. Draymond Green doesn't handle the ball exceptionally well. He's a decent ball handler for a guy who's 6'7", you know, 250 pounds.
Right.
He's a decent ball handler, but he's not going to be the one out there throwing up lob passes, hooking up with Andrew Bogut and Harrison Barnes and Maurice Spates down in the post. We saw a couple of careless turnovers last night by Draymond Green when the ball was out of Curry's hands. We saw the Cavaliers switching on those pick and rolls, essentially just not allowing Stephen Curry to have that half a second he needs to shoot, because the guy can shoot the ball in 0.4 seconds, which is pretty impressive. And the Cavaliers were able to take that jump shot away from him last night. So there's going to be a lot of keys to this series, you know, moving forward. Will LeBron James be able to put the team on his back like he has in Game 1 and Game 2? Will that translate into success in Game 3 and 4? Can J.R. Smith and Iman Shumpert kind of come out of the slumps that they were in? Can Matthew Dellavedova keep up this level of play that he's maintained through the first two games of this series and essentially through the entire playoffs when Kyrie Irving isn't on the floor? There's a lot of questions going into Game 3. Game 3 is tomorrow night. Who do you have winning Game 3 in Cleveland?
You know, I'm going to stick with my original pick of a five-game series. I'm going to say the Warriors win
the next two in Cleveland and swing back to game five.
And my reasoning for that is it's the Cavaliers both nights have fallen apart in the last 5 minutes of the game to allow the Warriors to get back. I think the Warriors make some changes, and I think that they – now, it'll be a close game, but I think the Warriors will come out ahead in both games.
Yeah.
And I don't see Curry setting another NBA record for missed shots.
Yeah, I don't either. And you know, I also don't see them setting another record of being. I don't see them the next game going to overtime. You know, this is the first time ever in NBA Finals history that the first two games have gone to overtime. I don't see that happening again. I think the Warriors come out tomorrow night in Cleveland and make a statement saying, "Hey, look, these first two games, you guys really played hard. You gave us two really good games. But we are the better team, and I think the Warriors are our team of destiny." When you look at their track record throughout the season, their track record during the playoffs, they really didn't have trouble beating anybody. They really didn't have trouble beating Memphis. They didn't have trouble with Houston. They didn't have trouble with the Pelicans. I think they kind of caught an easy break by not having to play either the Spurs or the Clippers in the first three rounds of the playoffs. But, you know, they've beaten the teams they've had to beat, and they've beaten them good. When you look at that team top to bottom and you see Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Harrison Barnes, Draymond Green, Andrew Bogut, Maurice Spates, Sean Livingston, Leandro Barbosa, Andre Iguodala, who has played a lot of important minutes in this series, I just don't see how the Cavaliers can be deep enough to beat this team. When you think about it, their starting five right now is Dellavedova, J.R. Smith, LeBron James, Tristan Thompson, and Timofey Mozgov. And then off the bench, you've got Shumpert, James Jones, and that's essentially it. I mean, you can throw guys out there like Kendrick Perkins, but is he really going to be valuable minutes off the bench in the finals? The answer is no. So I'm still sticking with six games because I think that the Cavaliers can win another game at home. I think they'll steal one. I think it's going to be game four because I think LeBron's going to want to even this series up before it goes back to Golden State. And then I think the next two games are the Warriors. So this has been one of the more entertaining finals. I think it will go down as one of the more historically entertaining finals because I think right now LeBron James is developing a real rival in Stephen Curry. I don't think those two have any disdain for each other, but I think from a standpoint of this is the first guy that's really been the guy that to challenge LeBron. When you look back at the teams that have beaten LeBron in the finals, those have been the San Antonio Spurs and the Dallas Mavericks. Those were really team-centric.
Well-rounded
right.
team, not a specific MVP
caliber player. And I'm not trying to say this isn't a well-rounded team because the Warriors, when firing on all cylinders, are one of the most talented teams in basketball, and all of those players can play at an all-star caliber when you look at them top to bottom. I think Harrison Barnes is an all-star caliber player. Andre Iguodala in the past has been an all-star caliber player. Even Leandro Barbosa, as a sixth man of the year before with the Phoenix Suns, can play at an all-star caliber level of basketball. But out of all those stars, when you look at Thompson and Barnes and Draymond Green and Bogut, Curry sticks out above the rest, and he's reaching this echelon, upper echelon of players in the NBA that I think has only been reached by a few guys in recent history, and that's LeBron James and Kevin Durant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think eventually Anthony Davis will get there. But I think Steph Curry's emerging into the conversation of being the second or third best player in this league behind LeBron James. So I think that's why you have that natural rivalry. I think the last time you really saw an alpha dog go up against LeBron like this was in the 2011 finals when they played the Oklahoma City Thunder and Kevin Durant. So I'm really looking to see Steph Curry emerge in these next couple of games and really make a statement as to why he is the MVP of the league. So you're still going with your pick in five games, which would mean that the Cavaliers are done winning games in this series. I think they still win one more. I think this game goes six. But I am excited to see how far this series can go. And I wouldn't be opposed to a game seven.
No.
I mean, I think as fans, our natural instinct is to want to see as much game as possible. I mean, even when I'm playing a video game with somebody, heck, I want the game to be close to the end of the game because you want that pressure. You want that intensity. So I think that's something we crave as fans. So I think everyone's wishing this series goes seven games. But we'll have to wait and see. So that's enough about enough basketball talk for the podcast. We want to get into the history that was made this week. You guys thought we would have forgotten about talking about the Belmont Stakes, but we did not. The racehorse American Pharoah breaks the 37-year drought to become the first Triple Crown winner since the racehorse Affirmed won, again, 37 years ago in 1978. And this is the longest drought ever in the Triple Crown history where we went without a winner. 37 years. It has never happened in our lifetime. May never ever happen again if we don't live in, you know, considering how long it took for it to happen. You think back to the historic moments in sports that have happened in our lifetime, and there's not many. This has got to be up there with them in terms of an American, not just sports history, but American history. I mean, horse racing is something that really is something that, you know, there's no specific fan base. There's no specific team that people root for. It's an American tradition, which is why it makes it an American history type of thing. You know, you in history class, you talk about the year that somebody won the Triple Crown. I mean, I think I got bored to death listening to our former computer teacher in high school, Mr. Kevin E. Miller, discuss Secretariat, who in his opinion was the greatest athlete ever to roam the earth. But it's really cool to see it, and it's cool to see it at Belmont Stakes in New York to see this moment for American Pharoah and for his owner or for his trainer, Bob Baffert to see this happen. You know, he's had a lot of horses in the past that have come close. And he's won. You know, Bob Baffert, the trainer for American Pharoah, he's won four Kentucky Derbies. He's won six Preaknesses. He's won two Belmont Stakes, so you see kind of the drop off there. So you see he's come close a couple times. It's great to see a guy like that, you know, get rewarded for his efforts and win a Triple Crown finally. And to be able to say, you know, we won't talk too much about the horse because, you know, it's a horse and it's not, there's no really human element to it. But for Bob Baffert, who just seems like a really likable guy, to be able to say he's an American Triple Crown winning trainer. That's a lot for your legacy. It's a lot for your reputation. So I'm happy for him, and I was glad to be able to see that moment on Sunday, or on, excuse me, on Saturday. Brody, where were you when you were watching it?
I was watching it at my house, and I mean, just the whole cultural aspect of all three of the races.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely want to go to the Kentucky Derby in the next few years.
Right.
Just, I think we're at the right age of maybe not the classness of it, but just going in, enjoying seeing the run
of
the horses and all that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, you know, to be said from a tradition standpoint. And you see the different traditions, like you kind of said. There's the, you know, Southern tradition of the Kentucky Derby, and there's the, you know, there's the Maryland tradition of the Preakness, and then there's that New York East Coast tradition of the Belmont Stakes. And when they played, you know, Frank Sinatra's New York, New York, that was just a really cool moment. You really feel the American history kind of alive there on the race ground. So really cool moment, not just for horse racing fans, but for the country to see that kind of monumental win by American Pharoah, and the American's in the name. So it's really cool. So to kind of wrap up this week, I wanted to talk about a trailer that just recently came out. It debuted today. It was a trailer I was looking forward to as soon as I found out that they were going to be turning this novel into a film. It was the trailer for The Martian. For those of you that don't know, The Martian is an American novel that was written by Andy Weir. It was published by Andy Weir in 2011, was released in 2014, which is when I read it. I read it just last summer. It's a great, great novel, and now they're making it into a movie. I won't talk too much about the story because I don't want to give too much of the story away, but the movie's obviously a big budget film. It's going to be starring Matt Damon as the lead character, as the astronaut who is marooned on Mars during an expedition gone wrong. His crew thinks that he has died and leaves him behind, only to find out that he is still alive and he has created a self-sustaining station on Mars. It's a really interesting book. It's a really interesting story about the human spirit and determination. And I'm excited to see it translate to the big screen because there's a lot of big names associated with this film. You look at the call sheet and you have Matt Damon, you have Jessica Chastain, Kristen Wiig from Saturday Night Live, Jeff Daniels, who has delivered, you know, hilarious and great dramatic performances in his career. You got Kate Mara, who many people who watch House of Cards know. You've got Sean Bean, who's a fan of Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, or movies where Sean Bean dies, knows who Sean Bean is. And then you have Academy Award nominee Chiwetel Ejiofor. And then you've got Childish Gambino, Donald Glover, who's going to be in the movie as well. So all-star studded cast of very recognizable names, and it looks to be a great film. Brody, as somebody who's not familiar with the novel, just having watched the trailer a few minutes ago, what are your thoughts on The Martian? Is it something you want to see? Are you looking forward to seeing it? If you do want to see it, what are your expectations of the movie?
You know, after seeing Gravity and Interstellar, the trailer really gives you a good appreciation for space and all of the different physical aspects.
Yeah.
Not only the human aspect of a man trying to survive, but all of that kind of environmental and everything. Mm-hmm. So I actually have really good expectations for this.
Yeah. You know, I'm excited. Having seen Gravity was okay. I really enjoyed the performances from Sandra Bullock and from George Clooney. I thought at times the story was a little slow and lacking, but you know, I got a little sick and tired of listening to people just breathe heavily out in space. But I really did enjoy Interstellar, just from a kind of philosophical standpoint. It was a movie that really made you think. Having read The Martian, this is a movie that's a lot about the same kind of will and determination from Matt Damon's character that he'll be portraying on the silver screen. I'm excited to see it because there haven't been a lot of movies about space made recently. At least from a realistic, you know, a realistic spatial standpoint. You see movies like Star Wars and Star Trek, but those are fiction. These are things that are science fiction, but they're more within the realm of possibility. And so that's why I'm excited to see this movie and excited to see the performance that Matt Damon delivers and really excited to see the cast that's surrounding him as well. So it's definitely a movie that we're going to have to keep our eyes out for. I'm not sure of the release date, but the release is in November of this year. So something that's coming out soon, I'm excited to see it, and we'll definitely have to get a good group together to go watch that as well. So that wraps up this week of the Built on the Border podcast. We guys want to thank you guys for listening. As always, you guys can reach out to us at builtontheborder@gmail.com or interact with us on Twitter at BorderKC or at our Twitter handles at BrodesMagodes or at Tommy Jeffy on Twitter. And we really want to hear from the fans because we know we don't have a huge listener base yet, but those who do listen, we really appreciate it. And we want to know how we can make this show better for you, how we can make it more interesting, how we can add different elements that make it more of a show for the fans, by the fans. And that's what we really wanted to deliver here with BuiltOnTheBorder.com. So we're going to leave you this week with one of the new songs, new tracks off of the Alabama Shakes' second studio album, Sound and Color. The song is Don't Want to Fight. It's a really good song. Alabama Shakes were just in Kansas City 2 weeks ago. We missed that concert. I was out on the road traveling. I think you had to go pick hops or something.
Yep.
So we had some prior obligations, but they're a great band, great music we like to listen to, and it's great tunes for the summer. So we're going to leave you with that Don't Want to Fight It. We'll see you guys next Monday, potentially. Not quite sure how the schedule is going to work out, but we should have a podcast out next Monday or Tuesday. So again, for Brody Johnson, I'm Tom Randolph. Have a great week. Stay cool. Enjoy the wonderful weather. And just have a good one out there, guys. Take care. Peace. Your line. Don't cross them lines. What you like. What I like. Why can't we both be right? Attacking. Defending. Until there's nothing left. Worth winning. Your pride. And my pride. Don't waste my time. No relief. Living on fire, the constant dedication, keeping the water and power on. There ain't no money left. Why can't I catch my breath? I'm gonna work myself to death.